Edward Snowden's new job today, Thursday, October 31st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. As the latest Snowden NSA revelation sets off alarm bells at Google and Yahoo, the man himself is reportedly taking a new IT job in Moscow. The details haven't been revealed yet.
You know, I mean, there is that sort of wonderful thing called, you know, the data commute. You know, he might be just working from home in his pajamas, but, you know, conceivably also he's going to be going to work.
Also today, Tel Aviv's spooky bus station.
It's megalomaniac. It's a structure that was built out of a fantasy world. It was meant not to be pleasant.
Plus, a bleary-eyed member of Red Sox Nation in Ireland remembers the moment he became a fan.
I still remember walking through under the stands into Fenway where you see the park itself, and at that moment there I was hooked.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
Koji ready. He turns on the rubber, the 2-2 home. Swing and a miss, he struck him out! The 2013 Red Sox are the world champions!
What? You didn't think we were going to start this show with a heavy news story, did you? We're in Boston, baby. This is Red Sox Nation. Now, to be fair, I'm a schizoid baseball fan, born in New York, rooted for the Yankees as a kid. But living in Boston since 95, it's impossible to resist the Red Sox storyline over the past decade. And this World Series victory was extra sweet because the Sox secured it on their home turf, Fenway Park, for the first time since 1918. Last night's Game 6 win over the St. Louis Cardinals kept Boston up all night. I went to bed with the sound of helicopters hovering over my house. Red Sox fan Garrett Pierce pulled an all-nighter because, well, Garrett, tell people where you are.
I live in Wicklow, Ireland.
Wicklow, Ireland. So I can't even calculate the time difference. Are you well rested today?
I am not. I'm sitting at my desk, nodding off, hoping my boss doesn't notice.
So how did you become a Red Sox fan, Garrett?
Well, actually, I ended up, as fate would have it, I ended up, when I came out of college, I got a work visa to the States, so I ended up in Boston. And one of the first things I'd been told to do, and I was more than happy to do, was go to Fenway Park. I still remember walking through into the from under the stands into Fenway, where you see the park itself. And I think that moment there, I was hooked.
Right, no turning back.
No turning back then. And even when I do, I've been lucky enough to get back with work, even last year, and it still gives me a sense of shivers down my spine when I walk out and see the green monster and see the stadium. It's just such a. I just think it's a magical place. It really is.
Yeah. Well, last year wasn't the best year to come and attend games at Fenway Park. But you followed the Sox worst to first story all year. What do you think made the difference in 2013?
I mean, they've got a lot of very talented players who probably had down years last year, but I think it's down to team play. I think they just seem to get the right mix of players and gritty guys who are just willing to do whatever it took to win, forget about their own stats, forget about whatever money they were earning, and just get out there and win.
Did the beards make any difference, you think?
Well, might have slowed them down going from first to third, but it certainly didn't seem to stop them in terms of getting the wins. I enjoyed watching them. I tried my poor son to watch some games online, the ones in the late afternoon, not the ones in the middle of the night, and he got hooked this year too, which is
good.
Great.
A new convert. Yeah. That great clincher moment last night with Koji Uehara's final pitch. You're a pitcher yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm delighted that somebody has finally put me in the same sentence as Koji Uehara and myself. But I play baseball. There's an Irish league here, which I got into after I came back from Boston and got into playing there.
How many teams in that league right now?
I think originally there was just six teams in the whole country. We're now up to, I think it's 12 teams with two divisions. So I played my time in the A-leagues right at the top of Irish baseball, which is nowhere near as glamorous as I like to make it sound sometimes. But I've moved back down to the minors in the B, serving out my working towards retirement now.
Are you serious? They have a minor league in Ireland?
No, well, it's a B-league. If you came and saw it, you'd laugh even more at the comparison. But no, it's a bunch of of Irish guys who love playing baseball, a bunch of expat Americans, people from the Dominican Republic, from Venezuela playing. It's great fun.
Well, today the B League is the league to be in Ireland and everywhere.
I would agree, absolutely.
Well, Garrett Pearce, next time you're in Boston, let's go out to Fenway Park together.
I would look forward to it. I can't wait to get back there after this year.
Garrett Pearce, Irish B-League pitcher and member of Red Sox Nation in Wicklow, Ireland. Thanks so much.
Great to be on.
Okay, try and turn your mental clock back to the last time the Sox sealed a World Series title at Fenway. What was going on 95 years ago? Well, more than a million Americans weren't home to follow the 1918 World Series. They were either fighting in the trenches of World War I's Western Front or on their way over there. The morning after that Game 6, U.S. troops launched a major attack near Saint-Mihiel in northern France. A week later, some 7,000 Americans or Allied French troops were either killed or wounded. Their sacrifice helped win the war for the Allies within a few weeks, giving rise to high hopes that there would never be a war like that again. But sadly, like the Boston Red Sox, Europe was cursed. Which brings us to our next story, the curse of Snowden. The National Security Agency feels it, and Russia loves it. NSA leaker Edward Snowden is pretty popular in the country that's granted him asylum. In fact, some Russians may hear something like this when they get to work tomorrow. Hey, say hello to Ed, your new IT guy. Seems Snowden has a new job in Russia, and rumor has it that he may be taking a position with Russia's equivalent of Facebook. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow tells us what he's heard.
The assumption is that he'll be working for Vkontakte, which is essentially a kind of a copy of Facebook. The interface looks identical. And he'll be there. And he was offered, actually, when he first took asylum here in Russia, the owner and founder of Vkontakte offered Snowden a job publicly, where he said he'd be happy to have Snowden on his team, basically to help secure users' privacy data.
So this was offered to him by a private company. I mean, but do you have any doubt that it's really the Russian government that lined up the job for him?
Well, I think obviously the Russian government helped line up the visa, which was the more kind of pressing point for him at that point. He'd been in the Sheremetyevo airport for the last month, kind of living in a sort of box. So I think, you know, certainly the Russians are taking care of him. We haven't seen much of him. You know, there's sort of purported sightings from time to time, but they're not confirmed. He was a recipient of a kind of a Freedom Prize through other U.S. whistleblowers who came to Moscow to celebrate with him. But other than that, he's been basically invisible.
So he's got asylum, he's got this visa, he's got a job now. For the Russians, is the Snowden case, is he really a propaganda tool more than anything else?
Well, I think there's some aspect of kind of gloating over the fact that Snowden, first of all, leaked all this information about the American surveillance system, the one called PRISM by the NSA. But on the other hand, it's a little bit disingenuous because the Russians have their own version of this. It's called SORM. It's a sort of a massive interception surveillance system that's been in place. Essentially, it was dreamed up by the KGB in the 1980s, and it gives essentially the successor agency to the KGB, the FSB, access to phone traffic and in subsequent versions and updates to this to internet providers. So in a lot of ways, it's very similar.
So let's shift gears here. I mean, the other person that figures into the shadowy world is Russian opposition activist Alexei Navalny. He was brought up on embezzlement charges in July. He's free now. But those charges, I guess, will prevent him from running for president, which he apparently wanted to do. What strikes you about the Navalny and the Snowden cases and what they say about Russia today?
Well, one thing that strikes me is that if you go back to that Navalny trial over the summer, they were playing recordings of Navalny with his apparent co-conspirator, Peter Ovtcherov, in this trial. And somebody was monitoring them. And one thing that was kind of interesting to notice is that nobody blinked about this. It was kind of just an assumption. And I think that, it's so obvious that this happens that, personally, I would be surprised to meet a Russian who was actually surprised about this. It's not entirely legal if you look sort of formally at the Constitution, but it's certainly an open secret.
How is Snowden kind of portrayed in Russia?
Well, he's portrayed as a hero, kind of a freedom fighter, but he's also portrayed constantly as someone who is under extreme threat from American security interests. So, part of this kind of idea of, you can't see him, he's invisible, is because the idea that he's a target for assassination or something else by the Americans.
And practical stuff. I mean, just wondering with this new job, how will Snowden get to work without attracting the attention of U.S. spies?
Well, I think that's a big question. I mean, there is that sort of wonderful thing called, the data commute. He might be just working from home in his pajamas, but, conceivably also he is going to be going to work.
Independent journalist Charles Maines, based in Moscow, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A lot of people in Spain could use a new job. After years of economic crisis, Spaniards are getting pretty creative about finding work. Reporter Jerry Haddon went in search of the oddest and most controversial ideas. He begins in Madrid.
For most sleepy commuters on Madrid's metro, the recorded voice announcing the next stop is just more white noise. But listen again. The voice said, Vodafone Sol. Vodafone as in the British telecom giant. Sol as in La Puerta del Sol, the sun's gate, Madrid's historic center. This summer, the region of Madrid sold that name to Vodafone for nearly $2 million. Most commuters I speak to are aghast but resigned. This gentleman, Tomás Sobra, says, Vodafone, Vodafone, I'm against the idea of selling the name to anyone. But, he says, money talks. The Metro System's Ignacio González agrees. The choice, he says, was selling the name or charging riders more money. I can understand that there might be some sentimentalism around the traditional name, he says, but from an economics point of view, being able to commercialize these places is very important. The city is selling more than just its names. Formerly protected historic buildings are on the block, as is artwork. Whatever can go must. You might call this the fire sale approach to solvency.
Silencio.
Silencio.
Venga, y acción.
Some 500 miles away, in a little town called Alhama de Murcia, the Perea family is also selling to survive, selling food. They have a restaurant. A couple of years ago, it was dying like many eateries in the area. Then owner David Perea had an idea. To make a TV series about the restaurant itself. The cast, his family. It's comedy on a shoestring.
Mama, mama, corre, corre!
¿Qué pasa?
In this recent episode, cousin Manolo goes into a trance after playing video games for too long. We've lost them, someone says. And just when the government has cut funding for home health care, says another. The whole thing is charmingly amateur, which is what director and restaurant owner David Perea says he's after. Viewers might say our technique isn't great, he says, but it's fresh. Perea even ropes me in, having me deliver an off-the-cuff cameo as myself, sort of.
Good evening, I'm Jerry Haddon, reporting live from the White House with very important news tonight. A restaurant in Murcia, Spain, is becoming extremely famous for its food and for the weird people who work there.
You can see the White House projected behind me on a blue screen. Perea's entire family looks on, giggling.
And the name of this restaurant is...
The episode ends in failure as the TV signal gets cut just before I announce the restaurant's name to the world. But the Pereas hardly need more publicity. The series is on regional TV every week, beamed into tens of thousands of homes. The dinner lines at the restaurant have grown long. So that's how one family's doing it. A day's drive away in the mountains of southern Andalusia, a whole town has banded together to beat the crisis, banded together in blue. Juzgar is the world's first official Smurf village. Every house, with the exception of one holdout, has been painted that telltale blue. Mayor David Fernandez says he was approached by a publicity group a couple years back, just as Sony was filming Smurfs 2. The sequel. Given our location, says Fernandez, the beautiful mountains, the small town atmosphere, and the large quantity of mushrooms that grow around here, this was the perfect place. Once blue, it's clear Juzgar residents really got into it. There are huge plastic statues of Smurfs everywhere. In the main bar, you can order blue spaghetti. On the weekends, there's an outdoor Smurf market. All this has put Juzgar on the tourist map. There's joy now. And a sense of hope for the future, Mayor Fernandez says, which, after 6 years of declining economic prospects in Spain, is no small thing.
Jerry Haddon is himself now very into the whole Smurf thing. Apparently, his family has started calling him Reporter Smurf. He's made us a movie, a real blue movie, and you can see it at PRI.org.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS. and from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom, in theaters now.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The push is back on in Washington to pass a broad immigration reform bill. Farmers have been making the case this week on Capitol Hill. They've been clamoring for help from Washington for years now to ease immigration barriers. But as The World's Jason Margolis found out from some dairy farmers in Idaho, they haven't always been so vocal about it.
There are three things you should know about Idaho. First, the cows.
Idaho is the third largest dairy state in the country.
Then the money.
And it brings about $3.25 billion into the Idaho economy.
And finally, the people milking those cows and making all that money.
Probably about 70% foreign-born labor.
The man supplying those figures is Brent Olmsted, a lobbyist for Idaho's dairy industry. We toured a large dairy farm together. A lot of farmers don't want to talk to reporters, so Olmsted does it for them. All the men I saw at the farm looked Hispanic. Olmsted gave me the standard spokesperson response when I asked if the workers here were legal.
All the dairies are required by federal law to fill out an I-9 form, which provides identification.
In other words, they check IDs. What else can they do?
Dairymen are exactly that. They're dairymen. They're not experts on identification protocols. They're not an enforcement arm, nor should they be the enforcement arm of the U.S. immigration network.
It can be a dangerous game, though. If the workers here are unauthorized immigrants, and if the farm gets audited, the owners could be in big trouble. Although raids don't happen much, plenty of stories circulate throughout the U.S. about workers getting detained and crops and money dying on the vine. It's been like this for decades now, and it makes Idaho dairy farmer Terry Jones fume with anger.
And now what do we have? I think we have chaos, and the government's at the center of this, and I think it's shameful that our Congress doesn't get their act together and get this thing resolved. They're too busy back there worrying about who's going to get the credit for what instead of what's good for our country.
I met Jones at an Ada County Farm Bureau meeting. Don Sankey is the Bureau's president. He, too, is upset with Congress, but he also points the finger at local farmers who stay silent.
I don't think there's 10% of the workforce that are actually here completely legal. Some of these owners, that they're not all that gung-ho about getting them legal because they got a handle over them if they know they can control them that way.
I asked Greg Hill, a public policy expert at Boise State University, if there was some truth to this, that the system is too profitable to fix.
I think you're reading into it correctly, that there is essentially a shadow economy. Take the milk industry, for example. They're not paying immigrants $5 an hour, illegal immigrants. They're paying them $10 or $12 an hour. The value added to businesses with respect to illegal immigrants is that they are a mobile workforce that can fill a niche in a way that non-immigrants can't.
Conservatives like former Republican State Senator Mike Jorgensen in northern Idaho take things a step further. Unauthorized workers are easily exploited.
They're a insulated work group that is very shy. They don't want to come out and complain. They just want the money and they'll do the work. So it's definitely what an agricultural state needs.
Make no mistake, though, Jorgensen is no crusader for immigrants' rights. He wants to fix things by sending unauthorized workers back home.
Idaho never used to have illegal employees. What we had was we had a lot of high school students who milked cows and did the fruit picking and things like that. Well, now those jobs aren't available for those high schoolers.
That's a quaint argument to Brent Olmsted with the dairy farmers.
I had an experience in northern Idaho meeting with a group that made the same argument. Northern Idaho, there were a lot of unemployed loggers. They had said that Americans will take these jobs. I bet them $100 that if we went down, found an unemployed logger, offered him a job milking cows at $14 an hour in southern Idaho, that they wouldn't take the job. The group I was meeting with would not take me up on the bet because they knew that was true.
Olmsted repeats his point. Idaho's dairy farmers need a stable, legal workforce. That means granting work permits and allowing current employees to get right with the law. He's not betting on change, though. After all, we haven't seen significant immigration reform since Ronald Reagan's time in the White House. Perhaps farm owners need to speak up a little louder for Washington to get the message. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Did I already mention that the Red Sox are world champions? Sorry, we Bostonians are a bit baseball crazy today. Not crazy enough, mind you, to open up a club where you encourage members to smash stuff with a baseball bat. But such a club actually does exist in Buenos Aires, Argentina. I'm not kidding. It's called the Break Club, and the BBC's Ignacio de los Reyes went there to check it out.
I met a couple of customers that worked in call centers or worked on IT support, and they were so happy to smash, especially the keyboard and the screen. These kind of jobs where you have so much stress dealing with angry customers, well, this was their own revenge with the computer.
So call centers and IT support, what other kinds of people are showing up to smash things?
Also, a lot of people working in creative jobs, like people working in media where you have to deal with deadlines. It's like you feel your brain is going to explode. Well, this is the place to go. Also, a lot of people working in advertising, especially people who work in these kind of jobs where you've already tried going to the gym, you've already tried therapy, and it's okay. It's a great place to release adrenaline and endorphins, but sometimes they need something else. Well, this is the place for them.
I've also heard, Ignacio, that there are more women showing up than men.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Actually, 85% of the clients in this break club in Argentina are women.
Why is that?
What Guido Dodero, the creator of this club, told me is that because Argentina is still quite a macho country, women still feel like they need to assume certain roles in society, that they have to stay in this particular role. And every now and then, they need to release all that tension. And, well, this is the place where they can be themselves, they can be angry with the world, and nobody is going to judge that. That's why it's so successful, especially among young women. But also, there was this lady in her 70s who actually went there, decided that, well, if we in our 30s or 40s have to deal with a lot of problems, what she says is like, well, imagine I've been through all of that and I'm in my 70s, so I have like twice the problems you have. So this is my turn to break and smash everything up.
Yeah, go for it, Granny. Take a bat and crack it all up. So this man you mentioned who started Break Club, does he collect money from the smashers?
He earns money by two ways. You can either pay for the stuff you break, and he provides whatever you like. Like, for instance, if you feel like smashing a TV screen, well, you can either take your own old TV screen to smash it, or you can ask for it.
Well, you can see Ignacio's video of the Break Club at PRI.org, which means that, Ignacio, your camera didn't get smashed because we've got the video to prove it. The BBC's Ignacio de los Reyes in Buenos Aires. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, the backstory of how the singing astronaut came back down to Earth.
As the Russian safety technician crawled inside and unstrapped me and dragged me out, the first thing he said to me was, Chris, your video to a clip, well, prekrasno, молодец, мальчик. You know, hey, I saw your video, it was great, way to go, man, really liked it. So what a way to come home.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The people of Iraq have endured so much violence over the past decade. Many of them just want out. Sarah Darwish is a young Iraqi doctor who left her country just this year. A month ago, she moved to Southern California. Sarah, hello, and welcome to the U.S.
Thank you so much.
How did you actually make it out of Iraq? I mean, what was going on when you left?
Well, It was the security situation, actually the disturbed security situation, that mostly made the daily life a really hard job. And this unstable security situation and the daily killing and bombs, that was very stressful, and I just couldn't concentrate on myself to get what I want, because these daily things was very horrible.
What was that like to be a doctor under those conditions? What kind of challenges did you face?
Well, it was pretty difficult to be in such situation, because the patients are, the Iraqi health system was very deteriorated, and the infrastructure was very poor, and the funds specified for health sector is very limited. So you suffer from limitation of medications and the necessary equipment. So that was the hard thing, because you feel in pain because you cannot help those people to get what they that they deserve,
right?
Especially
so,
even if it's a simple treatable condition.
Did you ever have any patients die that didn't have to die because of the lack of resources?
Yeah. It happens a lot, especially when during explosions, when we receive a high number of patients in the simple emergency room, and all of them in critical situations. And one of the things actually is the limited number of doctor and healthcare providers, because most of them like migrate to other countries. So that happens a lot.
Was it hard to leave Iraq, Sarah, knowing that even without the resources there, Iraq would be better off with one more doctor?
It is actually very, very hard. And I didn't think that it would be that much hard until I get here. Because when I got here and I saw life here, it is simple. And I feel more sorry for people of my country, because they deserve a better life and a better chances to have a good future. That's why it's very hard to see this, and I wish I can contribute more for them.
Are you having second thoughts?
For now, I'm working on evaluating my degree, and then I would have more choices and options to, to be of more benefit for my country.
Were you able to move to the U.S. with most of your family, and how's everyone doing?
I came to U.S. with my parents, and it's all good. We are settled, perhaps partially by now, because it's only been a month. But I left my relatives and my extended family, my very dear friends there. So I'm thinking of them all the time, because it's been hard to be away from them and worrying about them.
Do you think someday you'll go back to Iraq?
Yeah, I hope so.
What would it take to get you back? I mean, aside from security, is that all it needs, just more security?
For me, yes, because other things are durable and we can work on it. But the security situation is the main reason.
Sarah Darwish, a doctor who moved to California from Iraq a month ago. Sarah, let's stay in touch, shall we?
Sure thing.
The central bus station in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv used to be the largest in the world. A bigger one opened in India a few years back. But still, at 2.5 million square feet, the Tel Aviv bus station is a massive structure and a confusing maze of escalators and staircases, too. Reporter Daniel Estrin often finds himself there. But it was only this week, with Halloween in mind, that he went on a very spooky tour deep into the bowels of the station.
The Israeli architect responsible for this hulking concrete monolith was a champion of a fortress-like, blockish style of construction called Brutalist. And it is indeed brutal to find yourself in an M.C. Escher painting of escalators and staircases leading nowhere.
I think it's crazy. It's megalomaniac. It's a structure that was built out of a fantasy world.
Israeli artist Yonatan Mishal has been exploring the bus station for more than a decade and now leads his own tours here.
It was meant not to be pleasant. It was meant for people to get lost in, and when they can't find their way, they go shopping.
What's there to shop for? Today, there are a jumble of cheap stores selling cell phone covers and remote-controlled toy helicopters. Most of the shops here closed long ago, and about 60% of the building is abandoned. Or is it? There are people in these abandoned wings, folks you might call Israel's unwanted. Children of Filipino foreign workers run around in one of the forgotten corners of the bus station. They attend preschool and kindergarten in the central bus station.
It is able to be a place for people to hide or to find their place where they have no other place.
Ghosts also lurk here. 40,000 Jewish ghosts of the past. That's the number of Yiddish books kept in this dank warehouse, intended to be a Yiddish library and museum.
These are the rest of the 40,000 books I was telling you about
that oh my gosh.
Are still uncategorized. This is like a scene from Indiana Jones, like, you know, going into the place with the secret crates of the government.
We leave the Yiddish museum and pass a Filipino church and a breakdancing rehearsal space.
And now that we've seen the more inhabited parts and some of the bizarre parts, we're going to go deep under. Right, just as so.
Okay, wait a minute. This door says danger, entrance is forbidden.
Yeah, and that's where we're going. You can't follow the rules here because there are no rules in a central bus station.
It's totally dark down here.
And this brings us to our next stop where I'm going to meet a very old friend.
Oh my God. Okay. Oh my God, it's a statue of Charlie Chaplin. It's a movie theater complex abandoned in the 90s. There's debris everywhere. Yonatan wanted to host a horror film festival here, but the bus station management nixed it because the old movie theater doesn't meet modern safety requirements. We pass a locked synagogue in the corner and come upon a hallway with dusty pinball machines hiding in the dark. It's like one of those spooky carnival funhouses. We go down to the very bottom floor. Okay, this is psychedelic. Where are we?
We are now entering the nuclear bomb shelter. There are two sets of primary doors. One of them is a blast door. See how thick it is? We're talking about maybe 40 centimeters of steel.
Wow. And if a shelter for nuclear holocaust isn't creepy enough, there are bats.
The bats live in old bus tunnels that were blocked off in the 80s when the structure was still built. So there are these huge tunnels that were left unused, and the bats inhabited them because they're open to the air. They have like these openings. They could just go in and out. The bats, they're just part of the scenery. They don't do any harm. They're not blood-sucking bats, as far as I know.
Oh, but we come to a door behind a wall of concrete. Behind the door, we walk along a long, narrow tunnel flanked by metal claws. What is this place?
Your guess is as good as mine. I usually don't take people here because it is dangerous. Just let's be very careful. It's like a Sigourney Weaver movie, Alien, that she goes into these places. This is exactly what it looks like.
At the very end of the tunnel, a wall covered with names. Every inch scratched with names.
Who in the world are these people? Who came here and carved their names? No one comes here. So who are they? Really, I seriously raise the question of who these people are. And these are many people.
In the deepest bowel of the world's second largest bus station, my guide reveals to me what really creeps him out. That we're lurking around the deepest bowel of Tel Aviv's main bus station without raising the suspicion of the security guards who patrol it. When we passed a maintenance worker in the basement, he just stared at us.
Does it bother you?
It bothers me, yeah, because I think that these workers, they're the ones who know this place the best and they should take care of it, but they don't care about it. They just don't care. So anything, if there will be actually someone coming in here with bad intentions, he will just be able to do whatever he wants.
In this security-conscious country where bomb squads are called in regularly to blow up forgotten backpacks, anyone can wander free in the murkier wings of Tel Aviv's central bus station. Even for my fearless tour guide, Yonatan, The scariest part of his tour is that nobody's stopping him from leading it. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Tel Aviv.
We recently told you about the successes of Hoi Fong Sriracha Hot Sauce. You know the bottle with the green cap and the rooster on the label? Well, Sriracha is back in the headlines. We're talking fumes of the fresh jalapenos processed at the Sriracha factory in Irwindale, California. Apparently, people living in the area say the fumes are burning their eyes and throats. Now, if you think living next door to a pepper factory is bad, try working in one. Horticulturalist Stephanie Walker does. She works with the hottest peppers in the world at the Chili Pepper Institute in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Stephanie, I love them in food, but seriously, chili peppers are not to be messed with. I mean, they're used in pepper spray. So just how dangerous are chilies?
The capsaicinoid chemicals that are found in chili peppers are very irritating to human skin, mucous membranes, but people have really learned to love them and eat them. And yeah, I guess as long as you take it in the proper dose, it's a good thing.
Can you imagine what it's like for the neighbors of the Sriracha plant?
Yes, actually, years ago I worked at the largest green chili processing plant in the world. We did a product that was peeled jalapenos. We would wear respirators, a mask on our faces, gloves, but it was still a very difficult environment to work in inside the plant. And certainly I can see if fumes would get out of the plant. Certainly could be irritating to neighbors.
Now, I recently learned that Hoi Fong uses fresh red jalapenos in its recipe as opposed to, say, Tabasco, which uses only dry chili peppers. What difference does that make when, you know, they're cooking up the sauce in the factory?
Oh, well, certainly the different peppers will have different heat levels. And, I mean, people think of jalapenos as being hot, and they are, but really a hot jalapeno is only about 20,000 Scoville heat units with some range. We here down at the Chili Pepper Institute work with the Trinidad Moruga Scorpion Pepper, which has over 2 million Scoville heat units.
All right, so Trinidad Scorpion Pepper, what? I've never even seen that. What is that, some crazy pepper?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a variety of pepper that in replicated trials here at New Mexico State University, it is the one that's been identified by this institution so far as being the hottest ever.
So what do you do at the Institute? Do you ever have close calls with these things?
Certainly, you know, when we do our yield trials, we do our analysis, we have to take these very hot peppers, dry them, grind them, before we actually do the chemical analysis on them. So certainly student workers, technicians will occasionally get too big a dose of the capsaicin, have a coughing fit, watery eyes. Of course, we always are very careful to properly wash our hands after handling them, and preferably we use gloves, of course.
Yeah, you know, when I cook peppers, I prep them with dishwashing gloves. I mean, have you ever accidentally gotten a really hot pepper on the Scoville scale in your eye?
I don't think anyone that works really closely with the peppers has completely avoided that. So, yes, eventually you will at least get some of the volatile compounds in your eye.
Do you ever have to de-pepper yourself after work?
Yes, absolutely. A good soapy shower pretty much helps, although sometimes the chemical sensation will linger.
So I'm just curious, for the people in Irwindale, California, things get really hot there. I mean, is there anything the Sriracha factory can do to control the fumes and still kind of put out their product as they know it?
Sure, absolutely. First of all, just by increasing the filtration to keep the volatile compounds from drifting away from the factory. So, yeah, increasing the filtration, making sure that the factory is pretty closed up. It's still going to be tough on the factory workers, certainly, but you can take these steps to help protect the neighborhood.
Horticulturalist Stephanie Walker with the Chili Pepper Institute in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
What about your city? Does it have a particular factory aroma, say chocolate or beer? Tell us about it at PRI.org. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, Monday at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS. And by Lumosity.
Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. And does this ring a bell for you?
Can you hear? Am I sitting in a tin can? A last glimpse of the world. Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing left to do.
Singing from experience there, astronaut Chris Hadfield, his new memoir, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, is out this week. Chris, great to have you on the program.
Thanks very much for the invitation. Nice to talk with you, and fun to play that song back on Earth.
It's great to hear you play it back on Earth. I mean, we all know your version of David Bowie's Space Oddity when you performed it from the International Space Station. And it got so much attention, even when the Soyuz craft that you returned to Earth in, you plopped down there in Kazakhstan. It's the first thing the ground crew talks to you about, right?
Plopped is an interesting choice of verb right there. We plopped. We crashed back to Earth. It's rude coming home. But yeah, as the Russian safety technician crawled inside and unstrapped me and dragged me out, the first thing he said to me was, Chris, your video of toy clip, well, prekrasno, молодец, мальчик. You know, hey, I saw your video. It was great. Way to go, man. Really liked it. So what a way to come home.
Take us into space, if you would, Chris. What did it feel like the first time you walked out into nothing?
To be alone in the universe, kind of holding on with one hand, floating, weightless, you know, that just that is magic enough. But what really overwhelms everything is if you just glance up and to your right, the whole world is pouring by in this onslaught of visual explosion of beauty and texture. But what's weird about it is it's dead silent. It's like standing next to a raging fire or something with not any other sense except the visual of it. It's just surreal, the silent magnificence of the world. And you're just holding on with one hand. It's an incredible place to be.
That privilege to be out there. I mean, that's kind of what you were aiming for all your life by being an astronaut. But I guess being Canadian, that threw a couple of curveballs. So describe that moment at 9 years old. You're in Canada. You decide to become an astronaut. But you also know that it's going to be a possibly impossible mission.
You know, I watched Neil and Buzz walk onto the surface of the moon a July night, and I just thought they were the coolest guys ever, and thinking, I don't know how, but that's what I really want to do. And it, as you say, it wasn't just hard. Even if you're an American or a Soviet at the time where they had a program, imagine what it was like for everybody else in a country where they didn't have any astronaut program at all. It's like a impossible dream. But I figured it was impossible to walk on the moon this morning. So what the heck? I'm going to give it a try.
I mean, it's kind of crazy, but that's partially how the story went. I mean, you did everything you could training-wise, shy of astronaut training. And then one day in a Canadian newspaper, there's a classified ad that says, wanted astronauts?
Yeah, that's right. Just had to be a citizen, had to be able to pass a medical, and had to have a university degree. That's all they said.
Really?
And they stuck it in the papers. You know, it was pre-internet, like, you know, flicking through accountant, you know, manager, astronaut. It was all right there next to each other.
Earlier when we were talking about landing in Kazakhstan from this most recent mission, you wheeled out some pretty fluent Russian there. And I gather you were working in Russia at a place called the Yuri Gagarin Cosmonauts Training Center in Star City. What was it like living in Star City? Give us a picture of that place.
Star City is the historic place. It's where Yuri Gagarin and Valentina Tereshkova, some of the earliest cosmonauts, it's where they lived and worked and trained. It's like a small military base in the woods. On one side are a bunch of standard Soviet apartment blocks. On the other side, through another fence, are the training facilities. There's an enormous centrifuge that can pull 25G. There's a huge underwater training facility called, in English, the Hydro Lab. And there's space station simulators. And you live in the quarters. And every morning you walk through the green forest woods into the what they call the territory. You sit in classrooms. Your teacher, in Russian, of course, teaches you everything from orbital mechanics to control theory to how to use the toilet.
Wow.
It's quite the place to work, Star City. In Russian, it's Svyozny Gorodok, which means like starry town.
What do you guys do for fun there?
We play guitar.
some good really musicians great. Among the Russian crews?
Lots of Russian musicians. Lots of the NASA astronauts are musicians as well. I've been playing in the NASA astronaut band for the last 20 years. And
a NASA astronaut band? Wow. Say it isn't
yeah,
so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What kind of music? Max Q. Max Q. Bad music. We don't play all that well. But but mostly what you do in Star City really is study because it's complicated. And I was sort of like the pilot on my third flight. The first two flights I flew on the shuttle, but third one I was in the left seat, which made me like the pilot of the Soyuz, the Russian spaceship. And you fly it in Russian. And if the commander got like if he became sick while we were in orbit, I would have to fly the Soyuz back all by myself. So
was there like a training manual on the shelf in the Soyuz like there was in Gravity for Sandra Bullock?
Yeah, exactly.
Like just that. Pull it out. Yeah. You do write so lyrically about the experience of being in space, of looking down at Earth and seeing the beauty of this planet. Do you think you understand something about planet Earth that few people except perhaps astronauts grasp? And how do you impart that feeling to people on Earth so we're all better caretakers of the planet?
I don't think I can claim that I understand it better. I've definitely seen it more clearly than just about anyone. You know, to see it showing you its different light and different seasons and different weather, and where I start to look forward to little coves and little islands and how the lights in Boston are going to look tonight, because Boston's got almost like a beautiful circular shape around the harbor there, and it's just so pretty. You start to look forward to the whole world like a familiar friend, but also you get a feel for the whole thing as one place. And if I have any understanding, I did my best to show other people that, and people responded, not because I was trying to sell them anything, but just because I was inviting them on board.
Well, I've got to say, we're really grateful to you for making space a lot less distant. So thanks so much for that. And you're going to take us out with another pass on the guitar and a song that you wrote with the Canadian band Bare Naked Ladies, with their lead Ed Robertson, you wrote it with. It's called ISS, and that does not stand for International Space Station, does it?
That's right. ISS is somebody singing. And Ed insisted that we keep the words International Space Station in it, even though that's a really hard thing to rhyme. But it's in there in the middle of the song. And if you're ready, it goes something like this. You set?
We are set. Astronaut Chris Hadfield, thanks so much.
Here we go.
On solid fuel and wires, turn the key and light the fires. We're leaving Earth today. This rocket's burning bright. We'll soon be out of sight and orbiting in space.
I'm sure he's a great astronaut, but this is proof, if you needed it, that Chris Hadfield can really make music with the best of them. That's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great Halloween.
That ball of shiny blue houses everybody anybody ever knew.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.